First case on our calendar, 06617, Shelley Bickers versus Western Southern Life Insurance Company. Mr. Yun.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is George Yun, and I represent the appellant, Western Southern. With me today, who's also entered an appearance on behalf of Western Southern, is Keith Ashmish, who will be taking part of my time. What I'd like to do in terms of division of my time is 8 minutes for my argument in chief, and then cede 5 minutes to Mr. Ashmus, and then reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Good luck.
Thank you. Mr. Ashmus plans to address why the Coolidge decision is properly interpreted as being limited to employees who are protected from discharge by a statute requiring good cause, rather than expanded in the sweeping way that's suggested by the appellee and by the Employment Lawyers Association. I'd like to address why the Court of Appeals should be reversed, because its reading of this court's decision in Coolidge simply cannot be reconciled with other decisions of this court, in particular Wiles and Kulch.
Now, the counsel, I'm interested in what difference does it make to your client whether they fired this employee when they did versus waiting until she is able to return to work as off of temporary total?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then doing it at that time. Then you don't have any entanglement with Coolidge or anything else.
Well, the reason is because a company like my client, and in many cases smaller companies with fewer employees, is really hamstrung by the inability to go out and recruit a replacement for somebody who's on an indefinite absence, because temporary total disability can in many cases go on forever. It can go on for months, it can go on for years, and during that intervening time period, an employer, especially let's use the example of a smaller employer that has a couple very skilled, highly skilled, hard to replace employees.
Okay, so you fill the slot.
You fill the slot, if you can, with somebody of equal skill, and to go out and recruit people who have the necessary skills in many cases, you have to offer them indefinite employment opportunities, because they won't come to work for you if they have that skill set on a temporary basis. So that is the best example I can give you factually of why it matters to any employer.
What I'm curious about is the next shoe to then because we have these cases in which the employer argues, well, now your job's gone, now you're not entitled to compensation.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Okay, some employers try to argue, you're not entitled to compensation.
Yes, the voluntary abandonment.
Yes.
Yes, thanks for bringing that up. The difference there is that there is no case that has held or even hinted that somebody who violates a rule afterwards, after they're no longer able to work, when they're by definition off the employer's active payroll, can be accused of voluntary abandonment in a way that eliminates their right to temporary total disability compensation. The Gross case, this court's most recent pronouncement on that very subject, involves somebody who violated a safety rule while he was still working. And that's why he was ultimately disqualified from temporary total disability compensation. In a case like this, with all respect to my opponents, that's a straw man. It's a red herring. It doesn't happen that if you're already off and you've had a clean employment record and you gone off on temporary total disability because you've been injured on the job, that you could be accused of voluntary abandonment when you can't meet the employer's policy of, after your FMLA leave has expired, that you are required to come back to work after a certain time period, or be told that we can't hold the job open for you anymore. So I think that's the answer to the voluntary abandonment issue that was raised by Amicus, the Employment Lawyers Association, and the appellee here. Now, I've described the factual difficulty that an employer such as my client faces with the broad sweeping interpretation of Coolidge. The legal difficulty, of course.
How many employees does your client have?
Hundreds, I'm not sure exactly. It's a large, there's no question Your Honor, that it's a large, large employer.
And there was a discussion that, what did this employee do?
The record is incomplete on that. I'm afraid I can't answer that question because this was a motion to dismiss.
Some indication that there, your client couldn't accommodate any limited ability to work.
I think from what I know about the facts that, of course, are not in the record, that certainly it was alleged in a part of the complaint that is not on appeal, that my client refused or was unable to accommodate a light duty assignment. Yes, that's correct. So the factual difficulty, of course, is the ability to replace. The legal difficulty is that there's nothing in the workers' compensation statute that requires that a job be held open. There's nothing in the workers' compensation statute that talks about job hold rights or job protection rights except for 412390, which of course is part of this court's rationale in the Coolidge decision. But the 412390 provision against retaliation has its own remedy. And so of course the failure of the Coolidge decision to address the Wiles case that says that if the statute that provides the public policy also provides a remedy, that remedy is something that does not need augmentation by the public policy exception.
The Wiles case was a plurality. I joined the majority, but in judgment only, and I guess I should have written because it's apparently, what my view on that is apparently confusing. A lot of people, but it is just a plurality. And this court has looked at different kinds of statutes. In that one, it was the family leave.
Yes, Your Honor.
The result was that we were not going to extend it down to the smaller employers.
Well, I'm sorry.
But when the act by the employer was sexual harassment or inappropriate touching or those kinds of things.
As in the Collins case.
In the Collins case, we did so. Principally because there didn't seem to be any justification for not having those rules apply to employers of every size.
Yes, Your Honor, and those two cases can be reconciled because the source of the public policy defined in the Collins case was more than just the Ohio Civil Rights Act. It was throughout the statutes. Various statutes prohibit that kind of misconduct. In the FMLA, by contrast, the source of the public policy was limited to the FMLA, which had its own remedy, which also did not have compensatory and punitive damages available, just as 412390. And here, the source of the public policy is, at least in part, Section 412390. And if I'm to respect your admonition about good luck, I need to yield to Mr. Ashmus now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yund. Mr. Ashmus.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, I'm here to talk about why Coolidge does not govern this case. Coolidge was decided by this court, but it did not deal or did not create any public policy tort. Coolidge specifically was a case that was an appeal by a teacher from the termination of her continuing contract under 3319.16 under the good and just cause termination or determination. She appealed that determination to the Common Pleas Court. When it came to this court, the ruling of this court was that it was remanded with instructions that there had not been good and just cause found where the termination was for someone who was on a temporary total disability at the time of the termination, and that was the reason for the termination. Indeed, this court, in its jurisprudence, has determined that the public policy tort applies only to employees at will, which Ms. Coolidge was not. She was covered both by a collective bargaining agreement and by the state teacher protection statutes. In addition, Haynes was not even mentioned in the decision of the court. In addition, this court did not apply the four-factor test from Professor Parrott that it has established for determining whether there is a public policy tort. Specifically, this court did not deal with the issue of jeopardy and determine whether the entire policy of the workers' compensation statutes would be harmed by allowing an employer to apply a neutral attendance policy to individuals who were terminated while they were on temporary total disability. So therefore, Coolidge did not create a public policy tort.
Counsel, let me read you just one sentence, and there are plenty in Coolidge. Considering the statute is designed to provide the injured worker with the necessary means, and that's referring to the statute in the workers' comp code, is designed to provide the injured worker with the necessary means to subsist during the period of TTD, it would be inconsistent to allow the employer to fire such a worker solely because of the disability for which the employee is being compensated.
Well, two things on that. First of all,
there's no reference to the fact that she was a school teacher and had a continuing contract, anything of the kind.
Two things, Your Honor. First of all, the termination of employee on temporary total disability would have no effect on whether they're going to be entitled to continue to receive temporary total disability. So the compensation provisions would not be impacted by such a termination. Second, to the extent that that was not necessary to the decision of the case, it is a discussion of the court rather than something that is essential to the holding. And the holding of this court was simply that good and just cause did not exist for termination of a teacher under a continuing contract where the teacher was terminated while on temporary total disability. I also am here on behalf of the Ohio Management Lawyers Association, and on behalf of the Management Lawyers Association, I would urge the court to take a very careful look at its doctrine of public policy and the creation of these torts so that the proper recognition is given to the intent of the legislature, not just in the creation of the right, but also in who can raise the right, against whom it can be raised.
Do you folks think
procedures.
That we were wrong in Collins?
In Collins, you were correct because there were so much, there were criminal statutes involved in the conduct of the doctor in that case, but to the extent that it applied a public policy tort to a situation where the General Assembly had specifically decided that small employers should be exempt from the Civil Rights Act, yes, I think the court went too far on that. The result was correct in Collins, but the rationale and the extension of public policy torts to a violation of the Ohio Civil Rights Act by an employer specifically exempted by the General Assembly, I think, went too far. And the court should be sensitive to the considered judgments of the legislature when it applies public policy, particularly in considering the jeopardy claim. And I will stop there. Thank you.
Okay, can you just how do you see Wiles impacting this case?
I think that Wiles should be affirmed. And this court should make it clear that that is the rule of the state and remove any ambiguity. And that specifically where Wiles looked at what was an adequate remedy as opposed to a complete remedy, this court should find that the General Assembly's determination of what it determines is adequate is binding and ought to be accepted by this court absent very compelling reasons not to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ashmus. Mr. Giddes.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. The appellants in this case are essentially asking you not only to reverse the Coolidge decision, because there is no principled way to distinguish the public policy this court articulated in Coolidge as to applying to employees at will versus employees under a contract. But they're also asking you essentially to reverse almost approaching 20 years of jurisprudence of this court interpreting a common law. Why do I say that? First, since Greeley, which was argued in 1999, there have been numerous decisions, many of them cited in the briefs of this case, where this court has exercised its authority, solely your authority, to define the common law. Courts created employment at will, courts decide and balance the interests of when there are exceptions to it. It's a judicially created doctrine. Not once, in almost 20 years, 17 to be precise, has the legislature exercised its power, where this court has said it has, and they know it has, to preempt any of the public policy claims that you have recognized. Now, in Coolidge, this court, contrary to what you just heard, did not simply decide, gee, we're going to interpret 412390 as providing protection for employers and temporary total disability. In fact, the court's opinion makes it clear that 412390 probably has nothing to do with this. 412390 protects the process, the instituting of a workers' comp claim, the participation in the proceedings, not the receipt of benefits. And as this court unanimously said in Coolidge, it makes no sense that we're going to protect someone to ask for the benefits, but then turn around and allow them to be fired for getting them and getting the time necessary to recover.
Counsel, after Coolidge came out, there was a lot of consternation about dramatic change in law and public policy. You've done a lot of these cases. Have you seen a lot of lawsuits filed under the Coolidge doctrine?
No, but you know, there's another interesting aspect to this, and I think Justice Paffer touched on it. You know, there are no damages. You know, if you allow someone to stay off on temporary total disability, they're not accruing back pay because they're getting wages from workers' comp. They're not accruing health insurance issues because they're getting health insurance companies from workers' comp. So the potential impact of this case in terms of economics only comes if they willfully and knowingly violate this court's decision in Coolidge and fire somebody in the midst of getting TTD.
How do you deal then with their public policy argument, which was not raised as far as I recall because Coolidge did not involve anything beyond a school teacher at that point? How do you deal with the public policy argument, and how do we as a court deal with it involving the small company with the highly skilled worker example that he gave, which truly is an issue that maybe belongs somewhere else than here to consider?
Your Honor, I'm going to, if you'll permit me, let me first say, and I'll come back to it, Coolidge was a public policy decision, and if you'll give me a moment, I'll explain why. But the answer to your question is...
I'm just saying we didn't consider other issues when we looked at Coolidge. We were not looking, nobody presented that argument to us. That's my point.
Your Honor, the irony of my answer to you is the employment at will doctrine. I'm a small employer. Probably, well, I can't say everybody here, but many of us are small employers. When people get very sick or are disabled, it is common practice, even for small mom and pop companies, to hire temporary replacements. They have to. Contrary to what was just said to you, that there's no duty, nor is it practice, to guarantee job security even to temporary employees. These jobs are filled right now. It's happening all over the state every week, every day. There is no evidence or indication there is a crisis for either large, certainly not for large employers, or small employers who deal with attendance issues all the time. The Americans with Disability Act requires employers, you know, under federal law down to 15, and under the state law, even smaller, 5, as you know from the Collins-Riscana case, to accommodate people who are disabled, including attendance, unless it involves a fundamental performance of the job. There's adjustments of leave policies all the time. The FMLA, which applies to modestly sized employers down to 50, requires them to allow people to leave. I hear, you know, as we indicated in our briefs, the gates are not flooding open here. There is not a crisis. There's no indication of a crisis. This court articulated a policy in Coolidge, a common sense decency, if you will, out of the common law. Having this great bargain about workers' comp that this court talks about all the time wasn't a bargain that, gee, not only will we give up our right to sue you for our injuries at work, but we have to give up our jobs as well while we're getting benefits. That wasn't the bargain. And what this court said in Coolidge was that you were concerned that contract employees, or public teachers in that case that have job security, not have, and I'm quoting the opinion, less protection than an employee at will. You did discuss the elements of a public policy tort in Coolidge. First, you discussed the clarity element. First, you said it's clear, not based on just 412390, but on the act as a whole. In fact, the court talks about the structure of the whole act with emphasis on 412356, the receipt of benefits, and said that structure can't really work. It's not going, it's nothing, it's going to intimidate and have the same effect as retaliation as 412390 if every employee knows they are jeopardizing their future and their career just by accepting benefits. That, and this court cited the public policy cases, and Your Honor talked about the jeopardy element, saying it jeopardizes the policies.
Do you believe that gross impacts this at all? Can an employee make an argument that they didn't show up for work, so they violated the absentee policy and therefore were terminated?
Well, not under Coolidge. That's the whole point of Coolidge. If you make decision based on attendance, that's going to violate public policy. However, one of the elements that this court, every decision, plurality or majority, has said every time, is there are four elements to a public policy tort. The fourth is overriding business justification. It is simply not true that every employee has 100% guaranteed protection forever. If there are exceptional circumstances, if there's misconduct, suppose they discover resume fraud, or there have been violations of rules during employment. We cite, particularly Pelley cites in the brief, examples of cases where there is misconduct while on leave. The overriding business justification element of the public policy tort this court has recognized would allow an employer in those kinds of circumstances to terminate. It's not an absolute rule. I mean, public policy claims have four elements. One of them is an affirmative defense of overriding.
Well, counsel, are you saying that the employer would have the right to terminate an employee who, by virtue of an infraction of a hard and fast rule, injures himself and then is off work?
Well, Your Honor, I don't claim to be a workers' comp lawyer, but the decision I understand this court issued recently indicated that infractions, you know, knowing violations of safety rules could be a factor in whether they even get workers' comp.
Okay.
I mean, I don't claim to be a workers' comp person. But another point, though, I do know enough about workers' comp to know that this isn't this endless total temporary disability. Employers have a role in this. They can ask for medical examinations. There is the doctrine of maximum medical recovery, or MMI, maximum medical improvement. These are things that can bring to an end temporary disability, and as I indicated, the overriding business justification, which is a limited but affirmative defense, will allow for exceptions to the general rule this court has adopted. This court has a very flexible rule. Now, as to the adequacy of remedy argument, this case has nothing to do the notion here is that the appellants want you to say, gee, if the legislature provides a remedy for anything, no matter how bad it might be, no matter whether it serves the common law or not, and even if they haven't preempted the common law, too bad, you're stuck with it. Well, that's not this court's jurisprudence, never has been. First of all, this court has repeatedly said, and counsel pointed to Wiles, even the Wiles plurality opinion says that you don't even look at adequacy of remedy if there's multiple sources. If you read the Wiles quote, the core quote, it says, when there is a single source statute which has a remedy, then the adequacy becomes a question. Not that automatically you accept whatever it is. Here we clearly have multiple sources. In fact, the court's syllabus in Coolidge, written by the court, doesn't mention 412390, it mentions 412356. In the opinion alludes to the act as a whole, and then alludes also to 412390. It's a multiple source case, clearly. Apart from that, Wiles, again, I'm going to use the Wiles plurality because many people view it as the most conservative statement of this court about when there should be a public policy remedy. The Wiles court focused on the FMLA's relief. That relief was not like 412390. It allowed liquidated damages, back pay, front pay, back fringe benefits, interest by statute, attorney's fees, and actual damages. It went way beyond 412390. In fact, 412390, if you read the literal language, only allows the following: reinstatement of back pay. It doesn't even refer to benefits. There's only one case in the state of Ohio that's ever indicated or addressed the question of whether you can even get benefits under 412390. Compare its language to the Whistleblower Act, 411352, and in which this court in Colts said it was an inadequate remedy. And that portion of the opinion in Colts was not criticized in Wiles. Wiles distinguished it based on the fact that the FMLA had more relief. But what does the Whistleblower Act say? It says specifically, you get back pay, you get back fringe benefits, you get back seniority, you get either reinstatement or front pay, you get attorney's fees. It goes far beyond 4123.90. You said it was inadequate.
How do you reconcile or how do you assess the damages to somebody who's also receiving worker comp and would not normally receive those? Do you give them what they should have gotten on workers' comp? Do you give them what they would get from the date they were fired? Where do you start the damages running,
Your Honor,
and how do you assess it?
This court has incorporated into its public policy torts, like all torts, mitigation obligations. The reality of these cases, and I can tell you it's a conundrum for plaintiff's lawyers, if someone is terminated while they are temporarily totally disabled, putting aside a emotional distress or a punitive award, which I know of none right now, and it's been the law for several years now, there is no damage. There are no economic damages because they couldn't work. Unless you can prove there was an alternative position, like in an ADA case, there was light duty or an accommodation, in those cases there would be an accrual of the difference in the workers' comp benefits and what they would have earned. But in most cases, they are temporarily totally disabled. It's only when they recover that the damages arise because they should have still been employed, subject to later dismissal, because it's employment at will, as Your Honor pointed out. But at the moment in time they recover, they should have had insurance, and they should have had a job. Now, from that point going forward, if there were independent reasons or restructuring of the company, if like any other employee, they would have lost their job, or there's misconduct, or some other overriding business justification, their damages get cut off.
So but do you have to wait until they are able to return? Let's say they're fired year one, and they can't return to work for 3 years. How does that affect your statute of limitations? How do you assess damages? How do you figure out where they go?
Well, their damages may be largely mitigated in a circumstance like that, because for most of the period following their termination, they will have no economic damages unless they can prove there were jobs available that they could have been accommodated for. And then whatever window of time after they recover that they should have been brought back, where there's evidence that, and there's no justification for not bringing them back, other than some kind of retaliatory motive, there might be a window of economics. But that's what I mean. This is not the parade of horribles that the employers would have you believe. It's simply not true. Most of these positions are, you know, commonly, they replace people, they have leave policies, they deal with these situations, even small businesses do all the time.
Mr. Geddes, what did your client do?
She was known as a claims logger in the complaint. That's the reference. Obviously, I could extrapolate on the allegations since this is a 12B6, but that's what it says. I can't. At least the complaint doesn't allege it. I also would like to talk a moment about the equal protection issue here. This court in Coolidge, and what I think was a very clear message, is that, you know, claimants are a class of people. Now, the employers would like you to distinguish among them because one has a contract and one doesn't. But that's not what your opinion in Coolidge said. It's, you know, of course, some people have brown eyes, some people have blue eyes. Some people are technical employees, some people are clerical employees. Some people have contracts, some people don't. The issue is whether those differences are relevant to the public policy involved. Here, the public policy by the court applies to all workers' comp claimants. That is, we think, this court has indicated, we believe the time to recover and the right to receive benefits, not just apply for them, is protected by the Great Compromise and by the Workers' Compensation Act as a whole. And I would finish my argument, unless there are questions, by pointing this out. The legislature just did an overhaul of the workers' compensation statutes. They didn't address Coolidge. They have never, not once, repealed or modified any public policy decision you've made. And when the legislature wants to do it, you have told them how, and they knew how, even as long ago as in the early 90s. Take a look at 124.341, 124.341. There, as this court pointed out, here's clear language, because it deals with the whistleblower statute, says, for public employees, the sole and exclusive remedy, notwithstanding any other law, is, and in that case, limited the the remedy to an appeal.
You've used your time, Mr. Goodis.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Young, you saved just a little more than a minute of your time.
Thank you. I have four quick points in rebuttal. The first is that the legislature hasn't weighed in because it can't be expected to weigh into the confusion that's been created in the lower courts after the Coolidge decision. As recently as November of last year, this same appellate district, the first district, issued a decision that was contrary to the decision in this case in Bickers because it's confused about the state of the law under Coolidge. The second point is on the equal protection argument. It's no more an equal protection violation to interpret the law the way Mr. Ashmus and I are urging than it is for the legislature to say that only some class of employees are protected by the statute that says that they have to be given just, or they can only be discharged for good and just cause. Because under this scheme, the workers' comp scheme, everybody's entitled to temporary total disability. That's not the issue. The issue is whether or not they're entitled by some public policy derived from that statute, which provides compensation, not job protection rights, to have that job protection right. Third point, we have seen the floodgates. This case was filed in response to Coolidge. This case was filed after the Coolidge decision, and there are lots of others, and many of those cases have already generated Court of Appeals decisions that, as I said before, are in conflict with one another.
You need to sum up very quickly.
And my last point is that where a statute creating the policy, as this court found in Kulch, also has procedural prerequisites, the public policy claimant must have, quote, complied with all parts of the statute in order to bring a public policy claim. Ms. Bickers did not. The trial court was right to dismiss her complaint. The Court of Appeals should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.